Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program takes us to Portland for a meeting of the World Affairs Council of Maine. The speaker is Aaron David Miller, who has helped formulate U.S. policy on the Middle East and the Arab-Israeli peace process over the last two decades as an advisor to six secretaries of state. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Here's Aaron David Miller and his speech, Peace in the Middle East, Fact, Fiction, or Fantasy, on Speaking in Maine.
I had the honor and privilege over the course of a 25-year period of providing advice, some good, some bad, to six secretaries of state. During the course of these 25 years, which is a long time, I have a 29-year-old and a 26-year-old, so 25 years is a huge piece of somebody's life. And having just turned 60, I appreciate that now more than ever. But during these 25 years, I developed a profound faith, even though I'm not a religious person, in three basic propositions. One, that there was an equitable and durable solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I choose my words very carefully. I said equitable and durable, one that would meet the needs of both sides and one that would last. I'd said nothing about perfect justice, because there is no perfect justice. Again, I'm not a religious person, but I suspect this side of heaven there is no perfect justice. Nobody in this world gets 100%. In anything, let alone in a conflict this torturous and this complicated. Second, that the only way this equitable and durable solution could ever be delivered was through the long and imperfect process of negotiation. Imperfect because it's based on human frailty and weakness. Imperfect because it's based on the needs of nations and their domestic political constituencies. Imperfect because it takes an enormous amount of time. An enormous amount of time to produce. And finally, that the United States had a critical role to play in these matters. We couldn't impose, we couldn't deliver, but we alone had the capacity to assist Arabs and Israelis in this quest. Now, I still believe in these three basic propositions because, frankly, to not believe in them, to give up on them, means mortgaging the future, and no human being has the right to say never. But I would argue to you that all of these propositions today, June 2009, are all at sea. They are all highly arguable and all highly debatable. You cannot lose faith in them, because then you might as well give up. But you must look at the world with a certain clarity and honesty and free from as many illusions as you possibly can. This is as morally imperative as never giving up on the prospects that there can be peace between Arabs and Israelis. Looking at the world without illusion and looking at the world in a clear and honest fashion. So I want to share with you five or six observations drawn from the negotiator's highway with random comments sprinkled in about the Obama administration's approach toward this particular issue. Let me just say one additional thing. I approach this as an American because as much as I care about Israelis and Arabs and Palestinians, I care more, quite appropriately and rightly, about this country. And I worry. I see over the last 16 years, eight under Bill Clinton, for whom I worked, eight under George W. Bush, for whom I worked for two of the 8 years. I see America failing, stumbling, a kind of modern-day Gulliver, wandering around in a part of the world that it always understands too late, tied up into knots by small tribes whose interests sometimes are their own, sometimes not. And when they're not tying us up into knots, we're being tied up into knots by our own illusions and by our own domestic politics. A modern-day Gulliver. Well, We can't afford to be a modern-day Gulliver. If a great power cannot assist, as we couldn't for 8 years under Bill Clinton, helping to make peace between Arabs and Israelis, and if a great power cannot prosecute a war of choice, a discretionary war. Iraq was a war of choice. It was an optional war. And in optional wars, you better know what you're doing. And we didn't. But if a great power fails at peacemaking and fails at war making, then there's an arguable proposition that that great power is not a great power. And that worries me at a time when this region is more complicated than ever, holds some promise, but certainly many more challenges for American interests. I am hopeful that the new administration will learn many of the lessons, and this is a bipartisan message, many of the lessons from its failed Democratic predecessors, as well as its failed Republican predecessors, and draw the right lessons so that America can begin to succeed again. So let me quickly go through these. First and foremost, and this is my point of departure. I live on the Washington, D.C., Maryland line. There's no cross-border shelling there. There's no refugee camps there. There's no settlements there. For me, this is not an existential conflict. I put my kids on a bus when they were younger with every expectation that they would come home safe and sound. No Israeli or Palestinian parent, even today, can guarantee that their children will be safe and secure for 24 hours. The odds vary, of course, depending on whether you're an Israeli or Palestinian. But any odds are bad ones for a parent. So this is not an existential conflict for Americans. It is for Arabs and Israelis. And as a consequence of that, the decisions that need to be taken will ultimately have to be owned by the Arabs and Israelis themselves. The notion that somehow this Gulliver can impose that there should be all of these shoulds in our vocabularies. We're going to tell the Israelis how to do this. We're going to tell the Palestinians how to do that. Defies the logic of this region and defies success. Every breakthrough that was achieved, every one, Egypt-Israel, Jordan-Israel, Palestine-Israel, came without the knowledge or the involvement of the United States. Every single one. And that should tell you something about the nature of this process. Number two, without the United States, however, in my judgment, and I say this with great humility, keeping in mind the numbers of failures that we've had over the years, we also will not be able to achieve it. The conflict is too complex. The party's too nervous, too insecure. Their need's too great. They need a third party. And we are that third party. We are irreplaceable. We really are irreplaceable. Despite of all of our imperfections and our inadequacies and the failures of our policies, when we behave the right way, when we're tough, when we're fair, and when we're smart, America really can play a key role in effective peacemaking between the Arabs and the Israelis. And this means, point number two, that the President of the United States must make a decision. I'm writing a book now called Can America Have Another Great President? It'll come out when Barack Obama runs again in 2012. It's a look at presidential greatness. Roosevelt once said about Lincoln that Lincoln died a sad man because he couldn't have everything. Presidents need to make choices. Governing is about choosing. You can't have or do everything. President needs to make a judgment. Is the pursuit of Arab-Israeli peace going to be a top priority or not? If it's the latter, hang a close for the season sign on American policy, because we will get nowhere. We will get absolutely nowhere. Even if the president makes the judgment that it is a top priority, it may be too difficult. But that, in essence, that decision needs to be made. A choice needs to be made. My friend Larry Summers, who deals with economic issues, once said that in the history of the world, nobody ever washed a rental car. And in this in this statement is enough wisdom to fill at least one book of philosophy. Why don't you wash rental cars? You don't wash a rental car because you care. It is human nature. You care only about what you own. It may be sad. It may be hypocritical. But it is a piece of human nature. You care only, really, about what belongs to you. And the president needs to make this issue belong to him. Now, I would argue in the past 4 or 5 months, he, the president, has made it more or less unmistakably clear that this is a top priority. But the tough decisions that need to be made have not yet even been approached. Third, if you're going to have an agreement between Israelis and Palestinians, you're going to need an honest process. We haven't had an honest process since there has been a peace process. Not between these two. We have not had an honest process, in my judgment. Now, in part, this is our fault, ours, America's, for not understanding or rationalizing away the dishonesty of the process. But each side does things. I describe it this way. The Israelis wield what I call the power of the strong. Israelis are technologically, militarily, economically capable of imposing. They can impose their military power. They can impose their settlement policies. They impose. They impose in a variety of areas, some of which have nothing to do with Israeli security, but imposing land confiscation, settlement activity, bypass roads, housing demolitions, curfews, checkpoints, blockades. They create and undermine the very environment for negotiations that they seek, that you need in order to have a successful negotiation. That's the power of the strong. Palestinians, on the other hand, wield another power, which is very formidable. It's terrifying to behold. It's the power of the weak. And the power of the weak essentially says this, you know, we're the weakest party to this negotiation. You're occupying us. You have the support of a superpower. Our rights are being taken away as a consequence. We can acquiesce or validate any kind of behavior we want. We can level the playing field with you Israelis, and we can take away from you the one thing that we know you need more than anything, which is not only security, but a sense of security. So we can incite, and we can acquiesce in terror and violence. Arafat, to this day, and I roll this over my mind through countless hours and hours of meetings, never really abandoned violence. And I didn't understand this. I mean, I was naive in the extreme. I never could understand this, that from Arafat's perspective, it was a tool. It was an instrument available to the power, to those who were weak. And he used it, and he acquiesced in it. And in September of 2000, after an abortive Camp David summit that had no chance of succeeding, and it wasn't Arafat's fault that it didn't succeed, only, he let loose or acquiesced, and the tiger got out of the cage. And it hasn't gotten back in yet. When you marry the power of the strong and the power of the weak, you get a dysfunctional relationship, which is exactly what Israelis and Palestinians have, which is one of the reasons you don't have an agreement, and you're not going to even have a serious negotiation unless and until the process is honest. The president is absolutely right to talk tough and to try to get the Israelis to stop settlements, including natural growth, and he's absolutely right to press the Arabs and the Palestinians for the kind of parallel and reciprocal confidence builders that are required in order to create a measure of honesty in this process. Because if he doesn't, again, we're not going anywhere. Fourth, even if you got an honest process, you're then left with the core of the conflict. And what is the core of the conflict? The core of the conflict are four issues which drive intensely and furiously the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Until these four issues are resolved, negotiated honestly, there will be no end to this conflict. Jerusalem, borders, security, and refugees. Under these four issues, all other issues fall. These are territorial issues. These are identity issues. They make the Israeli-Palestinian conflict infinitely more complex than any of the other pieces of the Arab-Israeli conflict, surpassing the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty, the Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty, any conceivable deal between the Israelis and the Syrians. All of these are much easier to deal with than these four, because these four get to the issue of historical memory, of identity, of religion, and of proximity. It is proximity that makes the Israeli-Palestinian conflict so nasty. The lives of Israelis and Palestinians are inextricably linked. Their pasts, their presents, their futures, they are literally on top of one another. And unless the proximity problem is addressed, and the least bad way to address it is two states. The least bad way to address it is two states. It's the only rational outcome which allows the psychology, the politics, and the demography to align themselves with the hope of any possibility of a solution. But until now, no Israeli government and no Palestinian authority has been prepared to pay the price of what it would cost to create a conflict-ending agreement. And let me choose my words very carefully here. I said conflict-ending agreement. I say an agreement in which an Israeli prime minister and a Palestinian president would stand before their respective peoples and say, it is over. We do not love you. It may take years to fundamentally transform attitudes, but the fact is all claims have been addressed. All irredenta have been abandoned. All problems have been resolved. It's over. That is what I mean by a conflict-ending agreement. That will only happen when these four core issues are resolved to the satisfaction of both sides. Fifth, standing in the way of this outcome are two huge problems, which have nothing to do with the negotiations, but have to do with the internal politics of both sides. Diplomats, negotiators don't want to hear about domestic politics. They don't. But they make a fundamental mistake. Because domestic politics, whether you live in an authoritarian society or in a democracy, are absolutely critical to how you behave abroad. They, in some respects, dictate your foreign policy. And the domestic politics in Palestine and Israel right now are as confused and as fragmented as I've seen. My fifth point concerns the Palestinian national movement, which is fundamentally divided and dysfunctional. Hamas and Abbas now share control and have for several years of Palestine's guns, Palestine's people, and Palestine's legitimacy. There is no single source, no national source of Palestinian nationalism that could claim to speak now with the kind of legitimacy that is required to deliver an agreement. And until the issues that divide Palestinians are somehow ameliorated or addressed through elections, through national unity, through cooptation, through negotiation, it's very hard to envision or imagine a conflict-ending agreement. Because the mark of statehood, one of them, I don't care if it's the city of Portland or Oxford, Maine, where I live, or Chevy Chase, Maryland, or Egypt or Syria, it is the state's monopoly over the legitimate forces of violence within its society that determines how credible it is to its constituents and to its neighbors. That is to say, If you don't control all the guns, you control nothing. If you don't control all of the guns in your society, and I'm not talking about criminal enterprises, we're a walking poster child, this country, for the proliferation and diffusion of weapons. But we don't have groups with different ideologies controlling different parts of the country with a different charter aspiring to political and military actions. We don't have that here. And it exists in Palestine with a relentlessness and a fury that needs to somehow be fixed. Because if you don't control all the guns, your constituents will never respect you, and neither will your neighbors. Sixth, on the Israeli side, you have a more organized form of dysfunction and confusion. Israel is passing through a transition from a generation of founders who, whatever their imperfections, had the historic legitimacy and the moral authority to make decisions on behalf of the state. Some of the decisions were good, some of them were bad. But 61 years later, the state of Israel survives and prospers, despite all of its anomalies, all of its imperfections, all of its bad policies. It exists, and it's strong. That generation is gone. Shimon Peres, who is the president of the state, Ariel Sharon, who is in a coma, are the only two surviving members of that generation. And in their place has emerged a set of politicians, very smart politicians, but yet to be determined leaders. We don't know. We don't know whether Benjamin Netanyahu will have the moral authority or the historic legitimacy to deal with the 290,000 Israelis. 290,000 Israelis that who now live on the West Bank. What's going to happen? Even if 180,000 of them are incorporated into mutually acceptable blocks, which the Palestinians agree to, what happens to the other 80,000? Who has the moral authority and legitimacy to deal with this issue, to deal with Jerusalem as a political capital to Israel and Palestine, to deal with the issues of the Haram and the Har HaBayit, the overlapping sacred space that has bedeviled every negotiator? I don't know. And it's very worrisome. Because leadership is critical here. Very, very critical. Finally, let me close. This is not going to be easy. The Obama administration has made a very ambitious set of goals for itself on this issue. Forget the economy, forget Pakistan, Afghanistan, the implications of what's going to happen in Iran, healthcare. You have a potentially transformative president. You really do. Three great presidents, one in each century. Washington in the 18th, Lincoln in the 19th, Franklin Roosevelt in the 20th. It's now the 21st century. We're overdue, you could argue. Maybe Barack Obama will be a great president, maybe he won't. On this one, it's going to take an enormous amount of toughness, fairness, and smartness in order to prevail. And I will close with a quote from the first and last president. Obama may be the next one, but the first and last president who ever had an impact on me, Jack Kennedy. I was 13 when he was assassinated. I'll never forget where I was on that day. People say the same thing about Roosevelt. They'll, having been president four terms and died on April 12th of a cerebral hemorrhage, people say they also remember where they were when Roosevelt died. Kennedy described himself, and I've used this before, I want to say it again because I think it's good for those seeds who are here. Kennedy described himself in a wonderful way, and it's very appropriate to this conflict. He described himself as an idealist without illusion. An idealist without illusion. That's where America needs to be, never abandoning the notion that the Arab-Israeli conflict can be resolved and going about it with creativity and courage and commitment, but also going about it with our eyes wide open. Thank you very much.
Dr. Miller, you stated that America is a giant lumbering power, like Gulliver, that gets strapped down easily in foreign affairs. Recently? Yes? Did you?
It's
like Gulliver.
Yeah, a modern-day Gulliver. I mean, okay. Apologies to Jonathan Swift here, but the image is overwhelming to me. It's just very compelling, yeah. Right.
Would it not be better for America to lessen its involvement in foreign peace processes? And would it not be better for the peace processes itself, themselves, to not have a giant lumbering power interfering and probably causing more harm than good?
You know it's a very compelling argument that makes sense to a great many people. I just think it's too late for that now. We are in an investment trap. We are bogged down in a part of the world from which we cannot extricate ourselves, on one hand, because we have interests there, we have friends there, we have commitments that we've undertaken now for almost 60 years. But we also can't fix this region.
But we're causing more harm than good, then
why
are we still there?
Well, we can cause more harm than good, and I would argue our policies over the last 16 years, as I mentioned, have set us up for failure. But we can change some of that, some of it, by adjusting our software and our hardware, that is to say, how we conceive of the region and what we do about it. So the answer, I don't think, is to give up or to run away. I think the answer is to at least try to see whether or not you can adjust your policies to make them more effective. You're dealing with a, let's be clear, you're dealing with a very dysfunctional, angry, divided, conflict-ridden region. It's extraordinary to me how impervious this region has been over decades to fundamental change. It's a mystery. It's a fascinating question, and we're stuck there. There are more democracies in Africa now than there are in the entire Middle East. Now, why is that? I can't explain it. Others have tried. There are huge gaps between haves and have-nots and cans and cannots. There's a debate within Islam. There's an absence of legitimacy. There's a sense among young people that they're being excluded. There's a break between trade and cultural and intellectual exchanges between the Middle East and the rest of the world. The Arab Human Rights Report, two or three of them now in a row, point this out. We are in this region, and we can no longer afford to run away, and we can't fix it. So we have to figure out a way to manage with a view toward addressing some of these problems.
One more question. You're an author of many books on the subject. Have you ever been to the region?
Yeah, I mean, I would sadly now, for my wife Lindsay's sake and both of my kids, say that over the last 25 years, I've spent probably too much time there. I spent probably the bulk of my professional life between the mid-80s and the time I resigned from the State Department in January of 2003, there. I mean, just about everywhere.
Thank you.
A lot of time. Yes.
What you seem to suggest, am I talking loud enough? Okay, what you seem to suggest is that this is a crisis, a sort of a watershed crisis like July 1914 on the eve of World War I, or perhaps a Munich crisis in late 1938. In both those crises, we needed and lacked major concerted leadership to avoid war. My only question, if I've understood you right, that this is a crisis of similar proportions, even if it's more chronic, is it really? I mean, can't we just ignore this, let it take its course? Is it really that important for world peace that we have a president who, as Jimmy Carter did in the late 70s, devoted himself exclusively to a settlement, let everything else go, and even so could only record a rather limited degree of success?
Right. I mean, I probably done a great disservice because I never suggested and do not want to imply that the Arab-Israeli issue approaches the magnitude of either of the crises that you suggest, both of which triggered world wars. That's not what we're dealing with here. In fact, in a perverse way, the reason we still have this crisis, in a very perverse way, is because it always seems to remain within acceptable, tolerable bounds. It grinds on. Israelis and Palestinians have developed this extraordinary capacity to impose unlimited amounts of pain on the other and to absorb unlimited amounts of pain on themselves. No, this crisis has not gotten to the point where it is so prohibitive, so costly, and so unbelievably nasty that the Israelis and the Palestinians, like if George Mitchell were here, he would tell you that public opinion in Northern Ireland reached the point where normal human beings got sick and tired of the politics, the paramilitaries, the politicians. We're not there yet. No, that's not where we are. There are other problems in this region. America has forces in Afghanistan, in Iraq. The President of the United States committed himself during his campaign and again as president to extricate American forces from these areas. No, if you polled most Americans, they wouldn't put the Arab-Israeli issue high up on the list. They wouldn't. Pakistan is probably more of a threat to our interests than this conflict. My point to you, though, is that this is a unique conflict from our perspective because three things all come together on this one. Number one, it is in our national interests to try to do something about it. It's in our moral interests. It's the right thing to do. And finally, we have a demonstrated track record, even with all of our failures, of having influence. This is one of the few conflicts where all three of those things come together. We could actually make a contribution to this. So, no, it is not the world-shattering crisis that probably some of my dramatic presentation seemed to imply. But it is and can be a top priority for the United States because we have leverage, we have influence, we have a track record, and it would be a huge contribution if we could resolve another piece of it. Yes, in the way in the back. Yep.
Hi, good morning. My name is Rishi, and I am no expert on the Arab-Israeli conflict. I'm an Indian, actually. But from afar, whatever I heard and whatever I saw, what it seemed to me was that we were somewhere overstating the importance of America in this conflict. I mean, we talked about the salad, we talked about the juice on the table, but we didn't talk about the salad dressing. You know, the Arab states have a lot more in terms of what is invested in Israel-Palestine. We didn't speak about Jordan, we didn't speak about Egypt, we didn't speak about Lebanon. What I felt was, you said somewhere that this is like a bad investment for America. Not a bad investment, a long-term investment, which is trapped, a trapped investment.
Right.
If this is an investment for America, I think it's somewhat of an insurance policy for the rest of the Arab states. And I think it's okay if your investment goes wrong, but your life insurance should stay. So I think, yeah. So basically, I think we completely understated. The Arab equation was completely out of this. And the other thing I wanted to talk about was, you said when America looks smart, we act fair and just and smart.
Fair, tough, and smart.
Fair, tough, and smart. Sorry, that was the word. I studied a bit of pre-law, and one of the principles of justice was that justice should not just be done, it should also seem to be done. And I think it's one of the basic problems with America, that because of its long-term rendezvous with Israel, even though I believe in the fact that President Obama, especially after his speech, A New Beginning, was very impressed with it, I think he will be a fair moderator in this case. But I don't think at any juncture America can seem to be fair, or it cannot never seem that America is doing justice in spite of the fact that even it may in the near future. So I think that will be a major problem, at least for the Arab-Palestinian side. I don't think they completely trust America as a moderator. That's about it.
Those are two very good points. The second one first. Over the course of the last 40 years, we've had three successes in the Middle East in Arab-Israeli diplomacy, and only three. I have a chapter on each of them in my book. In each of those cases, America was tough, fair, and smart, which is one of the reasons we succeeded, and we delivered. So the notion that we can't be an effective broker, even though we have this remarkably close relationship with Israel, is an illusion. We have convinced ourselves somehow that we cannot be Israel's best friend on one hand and an honest broker in the Arab-Israeli conflict on the other. We can. We can be. It just requires a change in the software. And fighting with the Israelis is an occupational hazard when it comes to negotiations. My only point, and I'm not entirely sure the Obama administration has this one right, when you fight with the Israelis, it needs to be a fight with a purpose. There needs to be a reason to fight. And the reason should be achieving a breakthrough in the negotiations, because it's that breakthrough that makes the president look good. It's that breakthrough that advances American national interests. And it's that breakthrough, ultimately, which benefits both the Arabs and the Israelis. So I think we have a remarkably close relationship with Israel. I think it's the reason, frankly, that our phone rings. Believe me, if we had no relationship with the Israelis, our phone would not be ringing over the course of the last 40 years. It rings precisely because we are perceived to have influence with Israel. And when we use that relationship correctly, which we've done on three occasions, and only three occasions, Kissinger, Carter, and Baker, all achieved different things, but the tactics were the same in all cases. We can succeed. It's just since 1991, since the last time we had a serious foreign policy in this country, which was the last president's father and Jim Baker, we have failed. And we failed because we have persuaded ourselves for 8 years under Bill Clinton and 8 years under George W. Bush that somehow these two things were mutually exclusive. They're not. They're not mutually exclusive. With respect to the Arab states, they should, on paper and do in reality, have a much greater stake in the outcome, the disposition of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict than we do. Two of them, as you know, Egypt and Jordan, have signed full treaties of peace with the state of Israel. A third, Syria, and the Israelis signed a disengagement agreement on June 1st, 1974, which has made the Golan Heights the quietest piece of real estate in the entire region. So three Arab states have actually acted already on the proposition that, in fact, they do have an investment. Whether or not we can get the others who don't share contiguous borders with Israel to act accordingly is another matter. I don't know. The Obama administration's trying, to get stuff from them, even as it tries to get a settlements freeze from the Israelis.
Just one second. What I perceived out of what you said was that it's not the fact that America's extremely close relationship with Israel does not hinder it being a good broker.
It does when we allow it to.
When you allow it.
It doesn't have to when we don't want it to.
So I'm just going to draw a parallel here. I mean, I hope that is the case. I genuinely do. But I think America tried to play broker between India and Pakistan between the after the collapse of the Soviet Union to up till now. And we've had some agonizing moments post the 1990s as Indians because of America's rendezvous with Pakistan for a very long time, which again now is completely turned on its head because everybody hates Pakistan suddenly. And so what I'm trying to say is they are basically brokers of choice. And I think America has never brokered in a place where it doesn't have interest. And that's why the continuous switch between India and Pakistan. Today, because of the nuclear deal, I mean, we feel a lot safer in terms of international politics because we know that America is on our corner because of, the signing of the deal. So if you go to see past records, I don't think America is probably the best broker for this situation. I think, I don't know. I mean, I think peace should always be indigenous, and I think without the imposition of such a great power.
Right. Thank you. Yes.
I'd like to ask you more about, let's have a little follow-up discussion on what it is, perhaps in the internal politics of the Middle East, that is such a problem over the long run, the many, many countries. I did some research in the early 90s for my first book on NGOs in the Third World, and it was more peripheral than central because I was really focusing on Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and when I came to the Middle East, it was sort of very different. In terms of the explosion of NGOs that was occurring everywhere else. But I do remember reading some things about civil society in Palestine, which are extremely interesting. These were organizations that were working on social problems, that were working at the grassroots level. And my question, really, because I haven't kept up, really has to with that particular topic. It really has to do with what has happened to civil society in Palestine since the 90s, and in what way might that, in the long run, have some effect that could be positive on the international and negotiating issues that you've talked about?
Well, a healthy civil society is a function of circumstance, I suspect. It's a function of several. I haven't thought about this for 8 seconds, but it's a function of several variables. Number one is an environment and a climate to have a civil society. Civil society requires certain predictable, regular interactions between and among peoples.
Yeah.
Now, if your politics are dysfunctional, if your own let's leave the Israelis out of this for a minute. We'll get to them in a sec. If your own politics are dysfunctional, if there's no social contracts, no political social contract that regulates relationship between the governed and those who govern, how can you have a healthy civil society? How can you?
Well, maybe, but in
this one, it's under enormous stress. If you add to the mismanagement and corruption and lack of adequate representation, which characterize Palestinian politics, if you add to that the occupation and the unnatural dance that Israelis, deadly dance that Israelis and Palestinians have gone through since 1967, you have to wonder, a question I would ask is, why is there even prospects for civil society? There is, because Palestinians are incredibly resilient and find ways of organizing and operating in response to need, whether it's health care, education, mental health counseling, democratization. It's quite vibrant on the individual level. It's just extremely difficult to situate in a secure way. And in addition to that, you've got the whole question of trying to create institutions of self-government. I do not believe there is a precedent in history for a people negotiating its way out of an occupation and building the institutions of self-government at the same time. It's an enormous amount of stress. And if you add to that crises, incursions, you have a very unhealthy situation. And Gaza is emblematic of that dysfunction, it seems to me. So, I mean, in response to crisis, people organize at the grassroots level. Professionals who know their fields organize. I'm not suggesting there is no. There actually is quite an active organization. It's just competing against tremendous odds.
You made the comment that until you can control the guns in your country, there's no peace. And in conjunction with your last comment, I toured Gaza City in 1979. It was the first year I went with Bill Cohen during his first year in the Senate. And at that time, 40,000 Gazans were commuting to work every day, so that the standard of living in Gaza had tripled since Israel took over in 67. And the briefer said that, you know, their goal was to make this mutually beneficial relationship and dignity and so forth. And around that same time, the United States and Europe, at their expense, offered to knock down the refugee camps and build modern housing with water and sewer and buildings and schools. That was vetoed at the UN by the Arab countries because they didn't want to make it a permanent situation. And I spoke to one of the SEEDS graduates about that, and he said, well, the early 80s was the golden era of Gaza, where money was being circulated, and his family toured. He lived in Gaza City, took vacations to Europe and so forth. And then the guns came in, where they realized that the Arabs were going in the wrong direction as far as they were concerned, and sabotaged that, you know, requiring interfering with the commuting to work. Your thoughts about controlling the guns and how that can really, because I think the Palestinian people are the victims in here. And even he said, the graduate said, that we have a love-hate relationship with the Arabs. That we know they're using us for their purposes, but they are our brothers.
Yeah, this one is beyond the capacity, I think, of outside mediators to resolve. I don't know how many national movements in history reach moments where they impose their will on groups in the national movement, sometimes by force, deadly force, violence, and terror. And what emerges ultimately is a unified national movement with a directed political military strategy in order to address the problem of occupation, whether it was the VC during the Vietnam War against the French and the United States, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Russians, the IRA morphed into something else as a consequence of a political process, the FLN in Algeria, which was responsible for pushing the French out because they made the cost of the occupation too high for the occupier to bear. No such function, no such cohesion exists or has ever existed within the Palestinian National Movement. It remains today a movement in deep crisis with no centralized control, let alone a set of tactics designed to achieve Palestinian national aspiration. And this problem of how you reorder a national movement in the context of an occupation, an ongoing military confrontation with the Israelis, which is occurring, or which will, I predict, by the end of the year, also be occurring against the backdrop of a negotiation between the Israelis and the Palestinians. By the end of the year, probably sooner, there's going to be a resumption of negotiation. I don't have an answer to this. I really don't. And it's dishonest for me to suggest that anybody in this room, anybody in Washington, anybody anywhere, knows how to kind of put the Palestinian Humpty Dumpty back together again. But put together again, it must be. Because otherwise, no Palestinian leader will have the moral authority to make the kinds of concessions on Jerusalem and refugees without the broad support of the Palestinian polity. And I don't want to speak for the Israelis, but I can't imagine an Israeli prime minister who will make concessions to a Palestinian partner who doesn't, simply put, control all of the guns. I mean, again, not to overdo the Israeli piece of this, but what else do the Israelis get out of this arrangement with the Palestinians if not peace and quiet? If you don't get peace and quiet, what's the point of being in a negotiation? And peace and quiet means either by co-optation, by election, by repression, and that's how Arafat operated. You never would have seen this under Arafat. Never. He never would have permitted Hamas or, frankly, the free and fair elections that produced Hamas, parliamentary elections in 2006, to occur. Never would have permitted it. So you have democracy now, which has produced confusion. Then you had authoritarian behavior, which produced stability. But neither pathway has led to the point where the Palestinian national movement is unified enough to agree on what's the deal? Is it negotiate an end, or are you going to liberate Palestine by force? Choose, and then pursue an objective. But we're 60 years out, and confusion reigns. That's the problem. And I don't know if America can fix that.
We have time for one more question.
Yes.
Yeah, my question is, I think when Yitzhak Rabin was alive, or they have another leadership, at least they have more moderate leaders at the time. But now you think Hamas have right-wing leadership, while Israel has a right-wing leadership. Do you think right now is the best time, knowing that the both sides are far away from understanding reality?
It's a really interesting question. The story of peacemaking has always, at least in the Arab-Israeli conflict, has always belonged to the people who at one point or another used the guns for whatever purpose, whatever reason. Moral authority and historic legitimacy seems to flow toward men with guns. The history of peacemaking in Israel is basically a history of the right wing. People should understand that. The left has never been in the vanguard of peacemaking. Menachem Begin was the revisionist's revisionist. Rabin, you remember, even while we mourn him, was the breaker of Palestinian bones during the First Intifada. Rabin was a transformed hawk. That's what he was. He wasn't a dove. He was a transformed hawk. The left has hijacked his legacy and made statements in Rabin's name that he never would have accepted today if he were alive. Sharon, the only Israeli prime minister who ever could have dismantled settlements and dislodged settlers. Netanyahu, Olmert, Livni, it's all the right wing. It's been hawks walking the walk, never doves walking the walk, only talking the talk. It's a reality. It's the right wing, the sensible, pragmatic right wing. Hamas has enormous legitimacy on the streets of Palestine, perhaps by default, perhaps because Fatah is so corrupt, so divided, so dysfunctional. It just hasn't delivered. It hasn't delivered economically for Palestinians. It hasn't delivered politically for Palestinians. It hasn't ended settlements. Mahmoud Abbas sat and watched as good a man as there ever was, as well-intentioned, sat and watched the Israelis destroy large parts of Gaza, and he couldn't do anything about it. He couldn't use his relationship with Israel to stop it. He couldn't use his relationship with America to stop it. And 1,000 new myths and national narratives of struggle were born on the streets of Gaza in December 2008 and January 2009, myths that will not die easily. So Hamas has power. And bringing Hamas into a negotiation ultimately is going to have to happen, because without Palestinian unity, there will not be peace between Israelis and Palestinians. How that happens, over what period of time, I don't know. Thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to Aaron David Miller, advisor to 6 secretaries of state on speaking in Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, it will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. A service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.